Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, the very best A Song of Ice and Fire podcast in the world with boiled leather in the title. My name is Sean T. Collins. I am the creator of All Leather Must Be Boiled at BoiledLeather.com, which is the A Song of Ice and Fire blog where you probably found this podcast. I also am a television critic for Rolling Stone, where I write about Game of Thrones and various other fancy pants television programs. And I co-wrote the official annotated A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia and Anne Grohl for the Subtext iPad app. And joining me, as always, is my co-host.
Stefan Sasse, I am a writer for the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog of all things nerd, the Nerdstream Era, which you can find on thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And today we will talk about a very intriguing issue, which will be presented by Sean.
It's kind of a book report episode. We're talking about two, but well, book in a somewhat loose sense in one case. But today we'll be discussing The Lands of Ice and Fire, Maps from King's Landing to Across the Narrow Sea, which is the collection of maps of the world, overseen by George R. R. Martin and designed by cartographer Jonathan Roberts, which came out, I think it was earlier this month. Could have been November, I'm not exactly sure. And we will also be discussing A Flight of Sorrows, which is the essay collection, self-published as an ebook by Tower of the Hand, to which Stefan is a contributor in both the website and ebook incarnations. And it's sort of like a team effort between Tower of the Hand and various essayists for that site, and then also a podcast of Ice and Fire in the person of Mimi and Amin, who are favorite people of ours. So I think we'll get started with The Lands of Ice and Fire, which I posted a big review of on BoiledLeather.com a little while ago. And I really, really, really enjoyed this book, for lack of a better word. And by book, the reason I keep saying it's not really a book is because it's not. It's a giant book-shaped binder in which there are, how many, 12 pull-out maps that are the size of posters that you unfold, which I think took some people by surprise. I think they expected to, you know, a book, and it's not. It's a bunch of posters. But regardless of the format, I found it totally fascinating and totally exciting and just absolute nerd crack. And, you know, as I said in my review, there are quibbles that you can have with this, and I've seen them articulated, you know, in some detail and with a little more force than I brought to the table. The main one, I think, is that, you know, it contains the map of the known world, which is the first time that in any official capacity that Westeros and Essos and Sothorios, which is spelled a different time every time I see it, and everything it is all on the same map, so you can see where everything is relative to one another and the relative size and geographical, you know, longitudinal and latitudinal alignment and stuff. And you know, and that's super duper awesome, and for reasons I'll get into in a little bit. But once you've seen that, you've kind of seen them all. There are specialty maps. There's maps, city maps of King's Landing and Braavos, in particular, which do their own thing. There's a Journeys map that has, you know, the pathways, you know, the sort of Indiana Jones flying, you know, map style. Lines that show you where everybody started and where everybody went. And that does its own thing, obviously. It serves its own purpose. But once you get past the map of the known world, you know, you have sort of big, giant regional maps, like this is the West and the East and Central Essos. And then you have, you know, sub-regional maps. There's Westeros, there's, you know, the Slaver's Bay, there's the Free Cities, there's the Dothraki Sea, and things like that beyond the Wall. But none of those maps really add any detail to the map of the world in terms of new things that you can see in the smaller, you know, in this more close-up view that you couldn't see on the giant map of the world. They, with the exception of Westeros, where there simply are way more named towns and fortifications than could fit on the map of the world, you know, in terms of the names. They add the names in on the smaller maps of Westeros, whereas the map of the world just had little dots where those things existed. But there's still nothing new being added. And then, and in most of the other regions, the names are present in both. So you expect to be like zooming in and seeing more like it's Google Earth, but it's not. And in fact, it just draws attention to the gaps of information. Like the example I used in my review, there's a ruin and to the west of the city of Mantaris, and then there's an actual functional town or city slightly to the west of that ruin. Neither of which is named. I mean, they're shown on the map, but they're not named. And so then when you zoom in to a map that presents a closer view of that area, and instead of just being a little dot, now it's like someone drew like a tiny little drawing of a walled city with little three-dimensional buildings, and there's still no name. Like, it gets extra glaring, and that's a little frustrating. And the Journeys map is a little frustrating in that it's everyone crisscrosses each other's paths so much in the Riverlands that section of the map, which is really the most useful section of the map in terms of being able, you wanting to look at it and being like, okay, you know, Arya went this way and that way and this way, and I kind of want to see exactly where she was. You can't. It's too crowded with lines. And there was no cutaway section that blew it up a little bit and showed it, and, you know, more clearly. And that's frustrating to me. Again, as I said in the review, I'm sure there are discrepancies between the books and the map. Because there are discrepancies within the book, so why shouldn't there be discrepancies between the books and the map? But that's really pretty small beer, all that stuff. I still find, like, this is the kind of thing where, like, when everyone goes to bed, I pull out the maps, and I'll just sit with a beer and just nerd out. Just totally blissed out, looking at the city of the winged men. Far, like, you know, so far away from Qarth, that it's like the size of Westeros in between them. That's how far east it is. There's so much cool stuff here that you've never seen before, and it's super exciting to me. So that's my overview, mostly with an eye to the flaws, so that you can then subsequently ignore the flaws and get the book anyway. But Stefan, what did you think?
Yeah, it is interesting. When I read your review, I was... I realized that I was not in the same mind state about the map of the East, especially as you were, because when I opened it, I was surprised at first because these areas that are mapped out here, they are so large, and we have in parts never even heard of them. Just City of the Winged Men can stand is a stand-in for this. So yeah. What are the winged men exactly? Right, do they really have wings? We don't know, and probably we will never know. And I looked at these maps, and the distances became clear just how large the distances were, and how large this world is drawn. And I think it was on the Word Zone where we have a comparison with Middle Earth, I guess, so we can put things a little bit in perspective. And Martin's world really dwarfs every other fantasy world up to date. It is so large. It is incredible, and I'm still not sure what to feel about it. I don't have a bad feeling, like, oh my god, this is so stupid or something like that, but I am in a state of uncertainty about it, and perhaps this podcast will solve this problem in my head, because, as I said, when I look at the map of the East especially, it just seems very, very large. And the thought creeps in my mind, was this really necessary? Do we have to have all these barely known places that now have a name? I mean, there is the Bleeding Sea, the Dry Deep, the Cities of the Bloodless Men, the Mountains of the Morn. There is a whole new continent named Ulfos, stuff like that. And I have the impression that these will play no real part in the books. I may be corrected on that later, but I'm not sure if I would want them to be a part of the books, you know?
Right.
And that is a strange feeling. It is between the desire to know more about Martin's world, but also a little bit afraid of what I might find there. Because if you map out places only in the sketchiest terms, you are very prone to the danger of repeating certain formulas and tropes and cliches that are prevalent in so many fantasy stories. And stuff like the City of the Winged Men and a whole red sea called the Bleeding Sea, and that all, it sounds strange. I shared your excitement about the Shadowlands, for example, that they are overrun by ghost grass. That's really a very interesting and beautiful, hauntingly beautiful picture.
Yeah.
Or Valyria, that we get this clear look at Valyria and how it was composed relative to the other things.
Mm-hmm.
But this map of the East, I think, will have me thinking sometime.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about it is that it's not important, right? I mean, we know for sure that we will never see those places. That we'll never go... As far as we know, we're not even visiting Ashai. Just, you know, despite appearances to the contrary earlier in the series, let alone all these places to the east and north of Ashai, and south in the case of Ulthos, which just blew my mind. So, you know, these are really all sort of idle questions that aren't really going to have any kind of impact on the story. Even, most likely, just a seasoning. They won't be... They probably aren't even going to be sprinkled in, you know, the way, say, Yi Ti has been mentioned occasionally. I don't know that we'll ever hear anyone say the phrase, the City of the Winged Men.
Yeah, I guess, you know, not.
And so, to be honest, that's part of what makes this so exciting for me, is that the world is even much bigger than, you know, these many, many thousands of pages of prose can even begin to indicate. And it's not exciting to me in the sense that, like, ooh, look at all these ideas he has. He's so full of ideas. How does he do it? It's exciting to me for what it says about the world. You know, I just kind of really relish the idea that despite the obvious importance of what's going on to the characters, there's a whole world out there that continues regardless of what happens in Westeros. That main, you know, people have never heard of Westeros. They'll never get anywhere near anyone who's ever gotten near Westeros. And I've always thought that that's why the Essos material, you know, whether you're talking about the Free Cities or Slaver's Bay, has been present in the books to the degree that it has. Because I thought Martin's trying to tell us, to send us the message that, like, hey, people are playing the Game of Thrones everywhere. It's just a different throne that they're after. But that game's going on everywhere. And so the others take on the sort of metaphorical importance, which, again, I've always believed, that instead of fighting each other and being assholes to each other, like, we have common interests that we should be seeing to, and we're not. We're neglecting it. And that's to me, like, the real broad strokes, dumbed-down message of the entire series. That, like, stop killing each other, you dopes. You have bigger fish to fry as a species. That's the maps brought this home to me in a way that all, like, my sort of thinking while reading between the lines of the prose never really could, because it's just they showed how huge this world is and how there's all these cultural hubs, and, you know, you can see when you look at it all on a giant world map, you can see the ways in which you know, these sort of cultural connections and rivalries, you know, are suggested by geography of things, and, like, you know, it brings all that home in a really direct and visual way. And that's what I appreciated about it. And, you know, I appreciate the East for, like, the mystery that it represents and, like, how interesting it is to me, just the way my brain works, to be like, I wonder what the hell's going on out there. What are the five forts? Who built them? You know, who are they guarding against? You know, what gave the Maesters, because that's in theory, you know, that's the viewpoint from which these maps are developed, essentially. What gave them the idea that there's a city of winged men? You know, even it's because it seems out of character for the Maesters to think any such thing. You know, maybe that, like, nowadays they probably like, oh, well, we don't really think there's winged men. You know, there's that's just the designation of some city, and they're, you know, the record suggests blah, 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 blah. You know, these are all interesting things to think about, but for me, my main takeaway is sort of a philosophical one, and you know, and the maps made that concrete in a way that you know, prose can't.
I think there are two points that are very important to me in this. The first, that was really enlightening for me when I read your review about this thing that the Game of Thrones goes on everywhere. There is no safe haven. There is no paradise on Earth where all people live happily ever after, perhaps with the exception of Lazar. I don't know, but really, you have a world that is underdeveloped as it is. Still more believable than most fantasy worlds are. And the second thing is, when I look at the maps, they are really drawn from a Westerosi point of view. You see it in all these names. If you lived in a certain area, you wouldn't call your home Bone Town or the City of the Winged Men. That is a name that was given by someone who went there, or the Mountains of the Morn, or the Dry Deep. I mean, Westeros has some names like this, granted, but most of them still are more positive, so to speak. It is King's Landing and not the place where this butcher landed or something. The maps are still, although they are very complete to a level that the Maesters would never achieve, they are still drawn very much from this Westerosi perspective. I'm not quite sure whether this was an intentionally done thing or whether it just happened because not that much thought process went into it as to the more Western parts of this world.
You know, and you're right. That's an interesting point to make. That, like, even in the map that presents you everything, you're still seeing it from a Westerner's point of view. You know, it's funny because when that came up in the comments, some folks were like, you know, I'm a little bit. I got the sense that people were a little bit skittish about the maps in general, the whole project, because it's unreliable in that way. And it's like, well, just because it's unreliable doesn't mean that you can't get something of value out of it, you know, like we've been discussing. I think you can learn things about the world, you know, despite the fact that, like, you know, that the those areas, you know, are sort of depicted with a certain degree of cultural chauvinism. Do you know what I mean?
That is most surely the case. I mean, the distances and the fact that there exist cities everywhere, and we can almost see, although there are no borders drawn or something like that, we can still see possible conflict, sources of conflict. I mean, to stay in the east, these two cities that are depicted in the Shadowlands, Ashai and Stigi or whatever, they are most likely antagonists on some level and also cooperating, much like the cities on Slaver's Bay, for example. Or at the Hidden Sea, we have the City of the Winged Men and Carcosa. Both of them will be rivals on some level, but also certainly stick together if Bone Town decides to go through the Five Forts and attack them or something, you know? You can see entities and cultures, potentials for cultures, on these maps. Bone Town and Kedath is on the same plane, so most likely they will share some cultural aspects, and they will look at the peoples from Trader Town or Tikwi as strangers, or from this Nefer at the Thousand Islands. That is all. You can get these informations almost unconsciously from this map without having it spelled out for you.
Yes. Yeah, I think, you know, probably the best example of that, because it refers to a place that we've heard about before, a place of some importance, is, you know, as you brought up earlier, Ashai and the fact that the Shadowlands are overrun with ghost grass. You know, first of all, the idea of apocalyptic flora is really appealing to me and nightmarish to me. I actually wrote a comic about it. Called Here at the End of All Things. Let me get a plug in there. You can visit my website and order it. Anyway, it's SeanTCollins.com/comics. You'll find it there. You know, that's interesting. But then, like, you know, I start thinking, like, well, what does Ashai do to keep, you know, this uncontrollable plant out of not just the city limits, but wherever it grows, you know, its staple crops and stuff, you know? And you just start thinking about things in that way, and it's there's a lot of potential there. And I also think that, like, there is some story information that we can take away from these maps.
Yes, of course.
You know, relative to our own story. And to me, number one is, you know, people have given a lot of thought to what is the coming winter? The supernatural winter that the others come with, or that comes with the others. What does that mean to Essos, first of all? And, you know, George has said this, but it helps to see it all in one place, that, like, the northernmost parts of Essos are way south of the northernmost parts of Westeros. Like, with the exception of Ib, which turns out to be pretty far to the north, an island, you know, off the northern coast of Essos, sort of in central, right above Vaeus Dothrak. With that one exception, everything in Essos is south of Moat Cailin, which is kind of mind-blowing, and carries with it a lot of ramifications in terms of, you know, if this winter moves down from the north, who will it reach, and how fast will it reach them, and how fast could the triumphant others attack Essos if they wanted? And it would take some doing, you know, unless the entire sea froze solid and they could walk across the ice, which I grant you is not outside the realm of possibility. They're going to have to wait until they can get down far south, and we don't know if they can take ships or whatever, but it'll take some doing, because there's no land connection. There's nothing even close to a land connection between Essos and whatever that planet's equivalent of the North Pole is. That only exists in Westeros. So that's why Westeros is the front line for that conflict. That's why the Wall only exists on Westeros. There's no comparable structure in Essos, because there doesn't need to be. And that's interesting, and to a certain extent, that's new news.
Yeah, definitely. You can also get other information from the map. I mean, there are these bone mountains in the east of the Dothraki Sea, mm-hmm. that really run from the northern coast at the Shivering Sea to the southern coast at the Jade Sea. So the Dothraki most likely can't even cross these mountains, not with the Khalistan at least. Yeah. So that also explains why they don't go farther east to these plains of the Jogos Nai or something. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the Ashai is overrun by ghost grass explains why the Dothraki fear it so much and have this apocalyptic view of the world being devoured by ghost grass, because the Dothraki fear all kinds of magic, and the Ashai is the incorporation of magic. Yes. So this connection, making this connection, is really a thing that presents itself.
Wow, that's a terrific point. I had forgotten about that, but yeah. Because grass is their life. You're right. That's their whole life, and it's a throwaway thing that Jorah says to Dany in her, like, second chapter or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
And, like, third chapter. And, like, but yeah, I mean, when you look at it on the map and you see this region that's completely swallowed by this plant that that just destroys all of their plant life. And here's a city that has somehow managed to thrive, you know, on this tiny little point of that big, giant sort of subcontinent. Of course, if the Dothraki have heard anything about it or know anything about it, Like, that's going to be a really creepy place to them, because that's ghost grass on the Dothraki Sea would be the death of the Dothraki.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's a great point. Wow, I had never thought of it either.
And how you said you can get whole stories out of it. I mean, in the Plains of Jogos Nai, there is this shrinking sea that reminds me of the Aral Sea in Russia, because this seems to be a very big lake that at one time really had huge dimensions and is shrinking. In Russia, it's environmental problems, but here it could also be a magic source or what have not. But it must also be a very distinct setting to live in. When the water is receding more and more, especially on such a plain, and is leaving only a wasteland.
Yeah.
There is really much to get out of these maps. I have to admit, I didn't look at them in such detail as I'm now doing now. So there is much in this stuff, much more than I anticipated.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned in my review, you come to respect Well, there's a word for this, and I can't come up with it. But you know, the skill of the seafarers of the Summer Isles, because that place is way the hell out there, like surprisingly far. Like I'd always, you know, since the Summer Isles were comparable to Africa in terms of how the people look and to a certain extent the culture and the temperature and stuff, the climate. I kind of pictured the Summer Isles as these like nice islands. You know, off like the northern African coast or something like that. And the, you know, Sothorios was like a big continent right beneath, and it was all fairly close by to Dorne. But it's not. It's like way the hell out there. It's as far from Sunspear as, Goldtown? Almost? Dragonstone, certainly. So, like, that's really far for them to travel, and they're hella far away from the free cities. They're just as far away from Lys. You know, from Slaver's Bay, they're really distant. And like, so for them to not just have traveled to these places, but to like become famous for, you know, their shipcraft and their bows and sort of the renown that their culture has in terms of, you know, for lack of a better word, fashion, and, you know, and their sexuality and their religion and stuff, like, those guys are the real deal. Like, that's interesting to me. Thriving and successful and advanced culture to have made the mark that it did. You know.
It also shows you how desperate Excalibur Joe is if he seeks refuge in King's Landing in hopes that King's Landing will dispatch a fleet that helps him to into power.
Yeah, because they have a long way to travel.
Yeah, I mean, for a king's for Westerosi people, a sea voyage to Braavos is a very dangerous, daring enterprise.
Right.
But if you look at the distance, where there is nothing at all, to go to the Summer Isles or take the experiences of the Ironborn, who never travel outside the sight of land.
Yeah.
And they are seafaring people.
Right.
And then you have this huge distance. I mean, as you pointed out, it's almost as large as the north. Just water with no possibility to orient at all.
Yeah.
This is really a daring thing.
There are other places that are sort of have a similar thing going on. Like, you can now see Lonely Light, which is the furthest west of the Iron Islands, which is as far west from Pike as the Twins are to the east of Pike. Like, that place is really far, so no wonder those people are looked at as, like, weird freak mutants, by the rest of the Iron Islands. That's way far out there. And, like, you know, it's interesting that whatever they would be called, the Ibanese, or I forget the word for them, but Ib is, like...
Ibanese, yes.
Yeah. That's, like, way far up north, and, like, you know, that's gotta have its own... You know, it's alone, of all of Essos, it alone is as far north as it is. And it's still south of the Dreadfort, to give you some sense of the relative relationship. But, like, yeah, that's probably produced a very unique and odd culture as well, compared to the rest of the world. Yeah, so, I mean, it's just some fascinating stuff. And then there's some nerdy, funny stuff, too. Like, I noticed that, I don't know if we knew that there's an island off the northern coast of Sothorios, called Skull Island. I kind of wonder if King Kong lives there, because that's his home. You know, and it's, you know, this little, the City of Winged Men, I Googled it, and now I, let me see if I can Google it again, but that's a short story by somebody that I guess, Martin threw in there as a reference.
It just comes to my mind that if you are not disposed as benign as we are towards Martinsburg in general, you could make endless fun of these maps.
Yes.
Because some stuff of it is so grossly unrealistic. I mean, we are going on, oh, look at how cool the Summer Islanders are. You could also say it's completely unrealistic. It's total bullshit. Nobody could even manage that and simply bury the issue. So if you are into the more feet on the earth approach on this stuff and you want to keep it as gritty and realistic as you want, you maybe don't want to purchase this this package, or at least throw away all cards of these
right
all maps, sorry,
right.
That's really a problem.
Yeah.
Since we love all things Ice and Fire, I think we can get interesting stuff out of Mr. Martin's remnants,
right,
so to speak.
Yeah, I do want to point out that I am fully aware of how incredibly nerdy this discussion has been, and you know, the whole thing is, it's very nerdy. You know what I mean? Like, it's not something that you get necessarily for like your mom or dad, who, unless your mom or dad is a nerd, which is possible, I suppose. It happens. You know, that who got into these books because they heard good things or because they saw the show. Because there's a lot of what I would call civilians who are into these books now. And I'm not necessarily sure that this is the product for them. Although I did show a coworker of mine who I sort of consider a civilian. And she flipped out, although I don't think she would buy it and seek it out for herself. You know, they're for the hardcore and they're for people with an appreciation for this kind of thing. But there's a lot of us and, you know, and enjoy that aspect of it. It doesn't all have to be... you know, socio-political analysis of A Song of Ice and Fire. Like, you can just geek out about being able to see a map of Braavos, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Speaking of which, it is a rather strange choice to include Braavos in this map collection, because you don't get that much information out of the map. There are canals, yeah, I knew that before, and there are places. And in the city of Braavos especially, it doesn't really matter where anything is compared to each other, because you have these canals, you know.
Yeah.
It is supposed to be chaotic in some points.
Right.
So... do you have any idea why they included Braavos?
No, you know, I think it may even be in A Flight of Sorrows, although I'm not sure. Or it might have been in the Sorrowful Men podcast that you know, a bunch of the Tower guys did about A Flight of Sorrows. But someone pointed out that there's actually several storylines that seem headed toward Braavos.
Justin Massey
being the main one. The Sea Lord co-signed the marriage pact between Dorne and Viserys. Arya's still in there. You know, who knows who's going to hire the Faceless Men? Who knows what role they're going to play? Aren't there wildlings who fled Hardhome in Braavos? Did that happen?
Yeah, they were they were liberated, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's basically, you know, I'm reading into this that Braavos is going to play a major role, because you can ask yourself, like, well, why do Braavos instead of Meereen, for example, which has been a huge... you know, has played a much bigger part in the story, and the geography of which has been, I don't know, I mean, it's just been more of a setting than Braavos. I mean, Braavos is where Arya is, and it's where Sam was briefly, and that's it, right? So, why show Braavos and not Meereen if you're only going to do two city maps? And the only thing I can say to that is, good question. I assume there's a reason.
Or because the artist wanted to draw Braavos.
Yeah, I
could
guess
be
that's
as
possible
mundane
too.
As that.
That's possible too, sure. I just want to, for our listeners at home who can't see what's going on, my cat is trying to come and sit down on the couch next to me, but is finding herself unable to do so because there's an enormous map of the known world of Ice and Fire folded out on the couch, and there's no room for her. So I feel really bad for her. Come on, Lucy, you can do it. I'll close it up. That's fine. So now she's lost interest.
Yeah. Be glad that she didn't destroy the map.
Yes. I think it's interesting, by the way, that the minute we start talking about Braavos, a cat walks up to the map and starts snooping
yeah,
around.
Yeah, yeah, that's a sign.
Yes, yes, I think so.
As a side note, many people have pointed out in their criticisms about the Lands of Ice and Fire that the map of King's Landing doesn't have that many details. Supposedly, there are much more detailed maps of King's Landing to be found on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it is a poster-sized map of King's Landing,
yeah.
And it contains all the information we have from the books. So, but this may really be a complaint because it doesn't offer that much information. To be honest, there are many, many, many houses painted on it, but only few of them are named.
Yeah, I think a lot of those. I mean, King's Landing. I was not aware that there are detailed maps out there for consumption, and you know that's interesting to me. I guess you know, King's. I don't know how much detail I really need though for King's Landing. Like I am very grateful to see where the major landmarks are in relation to one another and in relation to the gates to Blackwater and stuff, because I just as a reader, I have a hard time navigating a city mentally. So I'm grateful for that.
yeah.
You know, and I don't know how much more beyond that I really need. But I mean, you know, yeah, I it doesn't surprise me that there's maybe more detail out there that could have been inserted but wasn't, because that's kind of the through line for all the maps. Like, there's a lot you would kind of expect a little bit more detail as you zoom in on some of these regions and subregions and in these cases cities, and you don't necessarily get it, and that's a legitimate criticism, don't get me wrong, but you know, I think some of these were made maybe with an eye to having a more decorative purpose than a strictly informational one. I don't know.
Yeah, that may very well be.
Well, I guess we could shift over to something that's purely informational, because there's no pictures, which is be my number one complaint. I can't read books with no pictures in them.
And there's one on the cover.
Oh, there's one on the cover. Good point. Good point. And that is A Flight of Sorrows, which to which you are a contributor, Stefan. And
yes.
We hashed out your essay in our last episode, which I still think is really, really excellent and eye-opening.
Thanks.
So if people want to pause and go back and listen to that one and freshen up, by all means do so. But I don't know. I mean, maybe you should get us started with this and, you know, and talk a little bit about what you think of the project as a participant. I don't know. I don't want to put you in any kind of awkward position if you're going to slam the thing, but.
Yeah, no, of course, everything I didn't do myself is rubbish. Yeah, you know, that's just the way it is. No, seriously, this was a project that was proposed by Mark, if I recall correctly. And the idea behind it was that we put together the regular contributors of the Tower of the Hand and the hosts of the Song of Ice and Fire podcast. And we do texts for this first ebook of the Tower of the Hand that were not previously published. So no collection of old stuff, but new and exclusive content, so to speak, so that you get some bang for the buck.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought long and hard about what to do for this collection, and I came down with this prophecy topic. I don't know exactly why, to be honest. We thought about having a major theme connecting all these things. But as you can imagine, coordinating so many writers that sometimes are continents apart is a problematic thing. And so we went more or less for the do-whatever-you-want approach. Mm-hmm. And so there came to be a very interesting collection. I don't think that you will ever read Flight of Sorrows and think, all stuff in there was great and enlightened me the same way. It comes down to what you expect and what you do want to read in any given situation.
Yeah.
But I guess it is the same with all our blogs, be it The Tower of the Hand, be it Boiled Leather, be it The Nurse Dreamera or what have you.
Right.
So I think you can find something of interest, at least, no matter how distant or unlikely your interests may be. So for me, the most interesting of the essays in the book, really no offense intended to anyone else, were The Telltale Knight by Mimi, The Game of Bats by Amin, and The Prince de Delirio Promise by Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Because these three really gave new insights to me about the story and the world of Ice and Fire. And when you hear Boiled Leather Audio Hour, you know what kind of stuff we are getting into, and these three met the profile, so to speak.
Yeah.
So just to present them in a very short way, The Prince de Delirio Promised tries to untangle the whole Aegon conspiracy. At first, the question, is Aegon the real deal, and what does the real deal even look like? So from the very few disparate information from A Dance with Dragons, Alex has drawn a very coherent picture. You have to admire the effort. He had to read Dance with Dragons very carefully for this. And Amin, in The Game of Bats, he basically looks into the role of marriage and of sex in the world of Ice and Fire, and this matches very much our profile for Leather Audio Hours. And at last, The Telltale Knight delves into the much-beloved Duncan Egg stories and sums them up for us. So that's my unique take on Flight of Sorrow. So what's yours?
Yeah, those are my favorites too. I think you're right. I mean, ultimately what you're looking for from a book like this is, are you getting new information and are you getting new insight? And is it presented in a coherent and pleasing way to read? And I think, you know, compared to something like Beyond the Wall, which is the essay collection that we previously talked about, with Elio and Linda and Alyssa Rosenberg. You know, I mean, you can see that this is, I mean, that was a book put out by a publishing house that does that sort of thing. They put out books collecting essays about notable elements of pop culture, and that's a professional, you know, publishing house, and that's what they do. I think this book read like what it was, which is, you know, a collection of essays by enthusiasts, which is perfectly fine. I mean, there are times when I felt like, oh, this needed tightening and that needed tightening, and maybe a few jokes here would have been helpful, and maybe a few fewer conspiracy theories here may have been helpful, and that sort of thing. You know, but I don't regret spending the money, because the essays that worked for me really worked and enlightened me. And the best example of that, well, I feel like they kind of did it in two different ways. You had essays like Amin's essay, which is A Game of Beds, which is about the impact of infidelity and adultery on the course of history, essentially, in the course of the story in particular. And then Mimi, you know, her essay, The Telltale Knight, about the Duncan Egg stories. You know, basically all they did was, you know, just sort of give an overview of a particular element of the story. You know, in Mimi's case, it was these prequel short stories / novellas, and in Amin's case, it was this one topic. But that can be really useful, and I it's something I do all the time as a writer myself about these books on Boiled Leather. Like, when I reread Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons simultaneously, I did multiple posts where I just, like, here's a single theme, here's a single topic, here's all the times it came up in these two books, and here's what I think of that, or here's what it meant, or whatever. But a lot of times, just putting it all together like that, it gets you 80% of the way there, because you've just never thought of it, you know, all together like that, because it's, you know, in the course of the series, it's woven into a million other things. And, you know, so by pulling it out and then synthesizing it into an essay, that's really useful. And it's really interesting, you know, the way Amin does that, for example. you know, because it brings up all sorts of issues about chivalry and about marriage and about sex and about gender roles and about childbirth and about the importance of the family unit and all these things that are maybe a little bit harder to see when everything's sort of diffuse and scattered. But he brought it all together. And, you know, with Mimi, it's different because she's talking about the entirety of these three stories. But, you know, they're stories that you maybe have read less often than you've read the main books, if at all. You know, they're harder. They're harder to find. They're like, you know, they're relatively obscure, frankly, compared to the main series, and they take place 100 years before or whatever. And you don't always necessarily make the connections with the main text. Well, that's what that's what this does for you, and that's really useful.
Yes.
You know, the final one is actually another one that I really liked as well. That I'm not sure that you had a copy of, because you were involved in the production process. But the prince that Illyrio promised, you know, does something similar in that it gives you the whole history. Everything we know about Illyrio and Varys's relationship with Aegon, quote-unquote Aegon, on one hand, and with Daenerys and Viserys on the other, and tries to figure out what the heck's going on by, you know, collecting all those facts. And that one really blew my mind, I think, more than anything else, just in terms of the one fact or the one insight that I took away from the whole book.
Yes.
And that was this. You can tell the relative importance to the overall Varys and Illyrio plot, the relative importance of Aegon on the one hand and Dany and Viserys on the other hand, by looking at those three characters' childhoods. Varys and Illyrio spent a fortune and spent years and hired multiple people to raise and train Aegon to be like the best possible kid he could be. Dany and Viserys, they just let him wander around. So if you were curious as to what the main plot is here and how and who's the real deal and who's the afterthought and you know how much relative care Illyrio and Varys were paying to Dany and Viserys and how important it was to them that this marriage with Drogo go well and all that stuff. And, you know, there's your answer. Not very. And that's really fascinating. You know, and it in some ways it raises some questions because now you're like, well, that's not the right way to put it. But like, it tells you also a lot about Illyrio just in this sense. Illyrio is a guy who could take three petrified dragon eggs, basically the most expensive objects in the entire world, maybe aside from maybe Valyrian steel swords, and give them to someone he expected to die. That's how rich that guy is. So, yeah. You know, you get a whole new appreciation from them in that way alone. So, yeah, I got a lot out of that essay in particular.
I have to basically totally agree with you because for me also, this essay provided the most new content that I didn't think about before in relation to other stuff. The other thing you mentioned about the themes and exploring themes, it is something I also like to do. And when I started on the essay of prophecies, that is my contribution to the book, I also wasn't quite sure whether I would get enough out of it, because I knew one thing beforehand. I didn't want to do any conspiracy theory or try to explain how prophecies solve thing, because there's so much of this out there. I mean, go to Westeros.org at any point in your life and you will find literally hundreds of threads that contemplate the weight of certain events in relation to prophecies, or how is this to be read and stuff. And to have a coherent and content in itself exploration of themes is something that such a thread can never offer you. So yeah. Even if you are a regular on the boards, and read your Tumblr blog and stuff. Such really insightful, complete texts you will only get in such compilations. And so they have their place as well, even though we normally also publish texts on the Tower of the Hand, for example.
Yeah.
So that is really an interesting process to read and to write about.
Yeah, and I just realized as you were talking that, like, I do this, I mean, you do this all the time, and I do this all the time, not just with stuff from A Song of Ice and Fire. Like, a lot of times I when I'm writing TV reviews for Rolling Stone, I get to a point where I'm like, am I just listing stuff? Like, am I just listing examples of a particular phenomenon or technique that this episode used to do? And a lot of times it's like, well, yeah. Because you when you see something happening over and over again, that's important to some way in the artist making that work of art. So it's worth listening, and it's worth trying to see the forest for the... It's taking all the trees and arranging them into a forest and then seeing what you can see. I think that's worthwhile. And yeah, as you said, like, you can get conspiracy theory and prophecy stuff from a lot of places. And I think that the collection ran into some difficulties when it went in that direction, which it didn't do a whole lot, to be honest with you. But, like, for example, Daggers in the Dark, which is the essay that Miles Schneiderman wrote about whether John is dead and what happened there. I found, like, very indulgent of very tenuous ideas regarding, just taking everyday turns of phrase and figures of speech that are used in the description of John's attack, the attack on John at the end of his final chapter in Dance, and doing what we readers do and reading a billion things into them, that, like, now everyone's being warged. Not warged. I can't believe I just did that. Wolves are warged. Nothing else is warged. Wargs are only for wolves. Skin changed or controlled in some way by Borok. Because the first guy who stabs John, when John turns to look at him, he's like, oh, it wasn't me. And it's just like, well, you see that happen all the time, right? When, like, if someone comes up and lands a cheap shot on someone and the guy turns around, people back away. That's what happens.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that's just human behavior. You don't need to read any more into it. And to me, it's much more interesting and useful to collect what's actually on the page and to make connections than it is to grab isolated things and make inferences from them. Because particularly with regards to magic and things like that. Because you end up seeing, as I always say, you end up looking at hoof prints and seeing and looking for zebras, and it's just a horse. So that you know, that's one thing that for example, that essay was much, much better when, because the point of the essay is John's not dead. John will be back. John's not, if he's dead, he's coming back. He will play a role. He will have agency. You know, he will be a he will have personhood and walk around and do things. Which I agree. But to me, it was much more persuasive when it made that argument by crunching the numbers on POV characters,
yes,
who have died, which I thought was a brilliant idea. You know, because everyone's like, hey, POV characters, he kills them all the time. Why do you think John doesn't have any plot armor? Why would you think that? And so what Schneiderman did was, okay, well, let's see. Well, here's how many POV characters we've had. And here's how many of them have had sort of fake-out deaths, where you end the chapter thinking that they've been killed because they've passed out, or, you know, the axe took her in the back of the head, that sort of thing. And then here's how many of have actually died. And then here's how many of the ones who have actually died have come back in some way. And here's how many main characters who aren't POV characters have died and come back in some way. And so on. Now, he ignores the epilogues and the prologues, which I think is a mistake, because those are, in theory, POV characters at least as much as the the little one-shot dudes like, you know, Aris Okart or whatever.
Yeah, but they die. They always die.
They always die, right, right. But that, I mean, that's a choice that Martin's making, to kill characters that you've seen through their eyes. So I think you can factor those in. But either way, you still come to the conclusion that, like, Martin basically doesn't kill off POV characters with anywhere near the frequency that you think he does. Just the times that he does it in such a spectacular fashion that you kind of overlook. You know, like with Ned, for example, he doesn't die while he's the POV character. You know, he dies during Arya's chapter. Yes. Catelyn, or Catelyn, which I can't stand that it's pronounced Catelyn. If you put an E in that name, use it. I think Chekhov wrote about that. Anyway, Catelyn, she dies, but then she comes back. And she's the other most prominent POV character who dies. You know, Rob's not a POV character. A lot of the major players who die aren't Renly. You know, you do get used to the shocks because it is shocking because they do kill off major characters all the time, but not really POVs. So, you know, just saying, oh, you know, hey man, doesn't matter that John's a POV character. He could still die. Yes, he could, but it's frankly unlikely. It's rarer than you think, and that's so much more persuasive to me than, like, John's fingers going, you know, John can't wield his sword, so that means someone's, like, magically messing with his brain, as opposed to him bleeding out because he was just stabbed in the neck, goddammit. Like, so he's losing feeling in his extremities. Like, I don't know why you'd read into things when you're so capable of actually taking what's there on the page, connecting it, and drawing sound conclusions from it. That, to me, is much more useful and compelling and convincing.
Yeah, just as a disclaimer, I wanted to add that we, of course, we could be full of shit too.
Yeah.
Our theories about Song of Ice and Fire being an anti-war story, for example, they could be pulled of thin air, so we are in no ways infallible. Right. Just to get that out of the way. We just have this feeling that you get more of such considerations if you look at the broader themes.
Yeah.
So it is in no ways to say that looking at these smaller events is inferior or something, because it's also much fun and we did it times and times again. But it is just our stick, so to speak, is to go into these theme thing because for us, it is the more, yeah, that sounds also very condescending, but the more meaningful part. I mean, it is interesting and exciting to think about who's dead and who's not and which prophecy will be fulfilled when, but the things that ultimately enrich our lives lie in the broader themes, in the thing we can learn out of this stuff. And
right.
I guess that is what at least you and I are searching.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, another element, you know, the one essay that did something slightly different, but I still found very useful, because it is Mark Kleinens' essay, which I think is the one that you haven't read. Because, like, it was maybe the last to be added to the manuscript or something like that. But, you know, he does an analysis of the series so far based on the three-act structure that George was accustomed to writing from his television work, which he's talked about at length. It's, you know, and normally I'm very wary of three-act structure as any kind of barometer for anything. I think it's a technique, it's a tool, but who cares, ultimately? I think it's been overrated by, you know, in comics, by comics writers who are taking lessons from you know, Robert McKee and these screenwriting books, and it's just like these are different things. You don't wedge yourself to these ideas. But George, this is an idea that George has had and has talked about, and, you know, it was originally supposed to be a trilogy, and, like, you can get a lot in terms of getting a sense of what's going on, what's important, where things are headed, what makes sense as a story, by looking at it as a three-act structure, and that's what Mark Kleinens's essay is about. And again, like, he points out things that I just hadn't thought of. This is another real eureka moment for me. He points out that the epilogues, we've only had two epilogues. Everyone thinks that the thing where Jockin / Pate comes back at the end of Feast for Crows is an epilogue. I did until I put the joined reading order together, and I was looking for the epilogue, and I was like, wait a minute, there is no epilogue. That's just a Samwell chapter. There's only two epilogues. There's the one with the Frey who gets killed by Lady Stoneheart at the end of Storm of Swords. And there's the one with Kevin getting killed by Varys at the end of Dance. Those take place at the ends of acts. That's what they're an epilogue to. Not that book, but that whole segment of story leading up to it. So the Frey thing is an epilogue to Game and Clash and Storm. The Kevin thing is an epilogue to Feast and Dance. And those are story units. And that's why people have talked about this, and some people think it's okay. Some people think it's positive, and some people dismiss it. But, like, that's why Feast and Dance feel the way they feel. They're the middle act. They're setting the table, basically. That's why, and that's important to consider. And that's all right there if you're looking at these things in the right way. You don't really need to read stuff into it. It's just like a basic literary analysis. And he also points out a theme that I had thought about to a certain extent, but not to the size that he sort of draws it out to, which is that in the second act, you're basically looking at like a whole new untested generation of rulers everywhere, rising up and trying to deal with what's been with the situation now that their forerunners are gone. And that's, like, I thought about it, and it's like, it's true. Like, Eddard's gone, Robert's gone, Tywin's gone, Balin's gone, the old bear is gone, Mance Rayder is gone, for all intents and purposes. Dany deposed the rulers of Slaver's Bay. And on and on it goes. And, like, that's the theme of the second act. And thinking about it as the second act makes the theme, more coherent. It's just a matter of looking at what's actually there and connecting it and drawing conclusions from it, instead of sort of building sort of castles made of sand. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, me too. I think this is a really great point about the story structure, because I never thought of it that way before. And it will certainly shape my take on the novels on the next reread. And I guess essays that can do this to really change how we perceive the novels when we read them again, these are the really great ones.
Right.
And I think this is a proper end for our podcast this time.
Yeah, I think so too. Hopefully we have changed how you all have perceived the novels, or perceive these books about the novels. This is we're going down the rabbit hole with this, I guess. But anyway, thanks again, everybody, for listening. Always, and Stefan, as always, it's a real pleasure to talk to you about this stuff.
You've
definitely changed how I've looked at these things, so
yeah,
I really
you too.
Appreciate it. Oh, all right, man. Mutual Admiration Society. That's what I like.
Oh, yes.
Well, thank you out there for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.